This is the Home Tech Podcast, Special Edition. Raspberry Pi, in the beginning. Featuring John Zadler, Microsoft MVP and host on the Home Server Show podcast. Also featuring Chris Barnes, host of the Digital Media Zone's End User podcast. And I am your host, Jim Collison. The Home Tech Podcast is a production of the Average Guy Podcasting Network.
Hello, this is a podcast about the Raspberry Pi and how come it's popular. And so Chris and I decided to get together with the help of Jim Collison from the Home Tech Podcast. And we're going to talk about the Raspberry Pi, why it's popular, some of the things we're kind of doing with it, some of the things you can do with it. So let's get started. Hi, Chris.
Hey, John. How's it going?
Doing all right. So you got yourself a Raspberry Pi?
I did. And that is the question. What am I going to do with this thing?
That's it, eh? Because a lot of these guys, they're, you know, the two biggest things that I find interesting with the Raspberry Pi is that the biggest pull for most people is that it does 1080p. So a lot of people are using it for as media player to play their video collection, so which is great. And then the other one is the GPIO port, which is a port on the back of it or on the one side there. I'll hold mine up to the camera here. And that's to interface to different hardware stuff. And then I guess you also have the people that want to get into some kind of software stuff with, Arch Linux or Debian or Fedora and all of that stuff.
Yeah, Chris, how did you acquire your Raspberry Pi? What'd you go through? Who'd you buy it from?
I got it from Newark. They're up in Canada, I believe.
And any problems getting? I assume you waited a while.
I ordered mine a little bit late, and I got it within a week or so.
Oh, okay. So they're shipping pretty quickly now.
Yeah, I wasn't in on that first wave of Raspberry Pis. I think they made 4,000 in the beginning of things, and then they opened it up a little wider, and I must have been on that second or third wave of things.
And there's a $25 version and a $35 version?
Well, not currently. The $25 version is not released yet. They haven't released that, although they've got it waiting in the wings, I guess. And the only difference between the two is that the $35 version, which is the Model B, has an Ethernet controller on it, and the $25 one does not.
Oh, so no, for us enthusiasts, no real sense in going $25 for the
most part, I don't think so. Okay. They were saying that they expect about 90% of the people who get a Raspberry Pi to get the Model B. That's probably true. For $10 more, why would you not, right?
Yeah, and you just got yours? It just came in?
Yeah, I've had it for maybe a week now, something like that, and it's pretty exciting.
You know, we hold those things around like this, you know, and I remember in the old days, right, you wouldn't even touch a circuit board without it being grounded properly. John, are you worried at all about your, you know, with the handling, with the handling of that like that, are you worried about messing anything up, circuits on there, anything like that?
No, not really, because one of the things is Eben Upton, who's the guy that kind of started all of this, he had made four goals of the Raspberry Pi, and basically one of the goals is for it to be robust, easy and convenient to carry around. So like he wanted, you know, students to be able to, kids to be able to handle it. There's a technology called like CMOS chips, you know, which if you touch them, you know, static, they would short unless they were grounded and stuff. So with the Pi, he wanted, you know, people to be able to, you know, or children to grab it and, you know, put it in their backpack, not have very delicate pieces on it that it would break off. This is one of the reasons they went with the SD card. Because a lot of people were saying, well, why don't you add a micro SD card? But then that's it. Micro SD card is a little harder. Well, it would be more hidden. It wouldn't be sticking out. But then it would, you know, kids would probably lose them quicker. So you can just kind of grab it and touch it all over. Just, you know, don't spill any water on it when it's plugged in.
Yeah, that's right.
Is it submergible? Can you submerge it in water while it's going in? Or maybe mineral oil, right? I've seen those mineral oil motherboard
things. That
probably
wouldn't hurt it.
Yeah. Chris, hold yours up again. Is yours different than John's or exactly same design?
I think they're exactly the same because this is the only one they're producing right now.
All right. And you got a, you've got your SD card in there.
Yep.
How big is that card?
I got a 4 gig SD card in there.
Very nice. And any restrictions on that card? Just your average run-of-the-mill SD card is what goes in there?
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of picked this one off my shelf and stuck it in there, and it happened to work. John, do you know, is there like an upper limit to these things? I'm not terribly sure.
Well, I know that if you go to raspberrypi.org, in their forums and stuff, they have like a compatibility list. So some people have spoken about the keyboards they've used, and even with the the wireless keyboards. So now you would have, let's say, a USB dongle. Some of them, it's like, do they have the driver? Other people were talking about these SD cards where some of the class, because you have, I think, is there a class 2? I'm not sure there's a class 2.
There's a bunch of them. There's SDX, you know, the high capacity ones and that kind of thing.
Yeah, because there's a 4, there's a 6, and I think there's a 10. And some guys were having issues with some of the faster ones, you know? So, I mean, your best bet, I would say, is to use it like a 4 gig stick and then copy your your OS to that one. And then have like that's it. Have one SD card for let's say your media center OS like RaspBMC. That's a nice. We'll put a link in the show notes for that one. It's basically XBMC software. So you can put that on one SD card. Then you would have let's say one for the Raspbian, which is the OS that you download from their site, which. Now you interact, you actually connect that to your monitor, you have your keyboard. You know, it's good for kids for programming software. I think that one of the software they give is Scratch. There's a browser in there. So,
yeah, there's Python on there as well.
Yeah. So then that's it. That one you put that on, let's say, on another card. And then if you want to try Arc Linux or something else. So now, you know, kind of give yourself, buy yourself a 4-pack or whatever. Don't put everything on, try and put everything on the 32-gig stick, you know. I would recommend a 4-gig stick.
Yeah, and I think 4 gig, if I'm not mistaken, is the highest that you can go without being SDHC, the high-capacity version. Mm. And then one step further up is SDX, if I remember right. And so, yeah, for compatibility's sake, I think the 4 gig is the ceiling.
Yep, so that's it. So basically, I'll show up here and we'll point to the parts here. So basically what happens is... like we said, it's credit card size. So, you know, take out your, if you don't have a Raspberry Pi, you know, take out your credit card from your wallet. You know, you can use it for two reasons, to see how big your Pi would be and to order one, you know.
Order one.
Yeah, or, well, that's your
more
two,
than one.
You're right. Now that they, just last month or a couple of weeks ago, they dropped the limit where, you know, you can order more than one. So that's
right,
pretty good
right.
Because apparently they started to, they're actually producing like 4,000 a day. So now there's no more that restriction, which was good that they did have a restriction because, you know, everybody wanted one and it was, you know, hard to get around. So basically what you have here is the you have the network connection. It's a 10-100. You have two USB ports, which is limited to 100. I think it's 140 milliamps. So sometimes, you know, if you try to connect a keyboard that has like a hub built into the keyboard and stuff, you're going to run into issues. So there's a limit there, and this is one of the points I suggest is that to get yourself a very good power supply, like a 1 amp or 2 amp power supply. But we'll just go around the board. So now over here, we have the HDMI connection, which is also supports the audio. So if you have a HDMI, because before earlier versions of the HDMI didn't support audio, in this case you do.
Now, John, if I can interrupt you there.
Yeah.
I don't know this off the top of my head. Does that support like the surround sound protocols and stuff like that?
I don't know. I don't know the details on that. I know it's a certain level, 1.3 or something, so I don't know what that entails. But I don't have a HD surround sound. Well, I have a HD surround, but not through a HDMI.
I'd have to imagine it doesn't because they have to buy a license for that kind of thing.
Okay. And then we have, on the other side of the board, we have a composite video, which is the yellow, which a lot of old TVs have these ones. There's no VGA connection, which was another standard. You do have, again, in the back, like I said, the SD card. They have a couple of nice little interfaces that I guess eventually will be used. This one over here, it's a little, I forget what they call these names, but it's a type of connection there. It's a flat ribbon connection. Basically, you if you see a little black bar, you kind of pull on it on each side very lightly. It'll only come out like an eighth of an inch, and then it'll drop to one side. And what you do is you put in the ribbon cable, and then you lock it again. So this one is supposed to be for their. Eventually, they're going to come out with a camera module that'll plug in right here behind the network connection, and then
The plans for that is a 5-megapixel sensor on there, so you'll eventually be able to take pictures with that thing.
Yeah,
that'll be pretty.
That'd make a nice little, we work with some local universities here, and they do a lot of robotics, especially around crawling robotics. And, of course, this would make, today they use full-size motherboards for those, for that implementation, so you'll see a little gigabyte, motherboard on there, whatever. But I imagine these Raspberry Pis might make an additional, a very nice, smaller footprint, maybe a little less power for something like that.
That's going to be their bread and butter, low-power computing for stuff like that. That's exactly right.
Yeah, and then they have a similar port here at the back. I think the VDS, I forget what they call it, but I think this is eventually going to be, you can connect like a LCD monitor. Don't bet on it there. Don't take my word for it there. But I think that's the case. So, and then right here in the back is your 20 I think it's 26 pin GPIO. So this is what's really nice about the board for the tech enthusiast who wants to put together some breadboarding, some experimenting, connect some LCD like let's say some 16x2 character displays. You want to maybe some motors for robotics and such. It's very you have to be very careful on these ports because the resistance is very low. You don't want to blow it out. So there is some interface boards that you can buy. So I would suggest there's a site, adafruit.com. We'll put, a link. And what you do is you end up getting like these sort of like breadboards like this here. And, you put all your components in it. And like I'm going to be wiring up these LCD screens. Adafruit, they sell something called the Cobbler. So basically what it is, it's... you have a cable, a flat ribbon cable like this, and that'll plug onto the board here. So you make sure you plug it in the right orientation. And then the other part of the board will go on their interface, which is on that little breadboard that you buy from them, or if you have the breadboard, that's fine. So you'll plug this guy onto there, and then you'll plug it onto the... you'll plug it to the... it's facing me. Then you'll plug it onto their little cobbler, which is a little blue interface. There goes my pie. a little interface board on here, and then you can wire all the stuff. So this is what's nice about, you can change the configuration. You can test it before you connect it to your Pi. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
So John, you've already tested in the course of the show the robustness of the board.
Exactly, a few times. And the other board, there's another board which they just started talking about it. I don't know if you're familiar with it, the GERT board. There's some links, again, we'll put it to raspberrypi.org. And one of the developers, guys that was very instrumental on helping out with the Raspberry Pi project, he made a board. So we'll put some links. And have you seen that one? Have you heard about
it? So I haven't seen one in person because I haven't ordered one or anything. But that looks really interesting because it's not just a breakout to a breadboard like the Cobbler is. It serves kind of a different purpose. They've got a bunch of IC chips on there and a bunch of LEDs and a bunch of stuff like that so that you can kind of get started without having to wire up all the LEDs yourself. So that's kind of neat.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Like I said, this guy was instrumental in the development of the Raspberry Pi, so he knows a lot of that background knowledge. So then he kind of knew, and because it's for students, they want to be able to have that, like you said, an interface where, you have a few levels, right? You can say, all right, it's a board. Unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, you have to assemble this board. It's not like the Raspberry Pi that comes pre-assembled. You do have to assemble it, and a lot of the components are surface mount components, which are really tiny. So you better have a magnifying glass, or you better teach your 8-year-old how to solder because they have better eyesight than you.
Yeah, so, surface mount components are really tough to work with compared to the traditional DIP components. You got to like put them in an oven and stuff like that and have special tools to work with them.
Okay. Well, I know on their site there, they're showing there's a little demo on how to solder, and they were kind of doing it pretty nice with the, just a little soldering iron and stuff. But professionally, yeah, usually you heat the board and you put the – that's how they do it professionally there. You know, you heat the board, you put – I guess they put some solder, they put the compound, the connectors or components, and then bang, they just stick.
I've seen some people around the community, maybe not with the GERT board, but with Arduino and all of that, using like an Easy Bake Oven and that kind of thing to
really,
to mount some surface mount components.
Easy
so,
Bake.
People will find a way.
John, while we have a second, we've picked up quite a few viewers on YouTube, and let me let folks know if they are watching on the G Plus or YouTube, you can join us for some chat if you want to ask these guys some questions or get your questions answered. Jump over to theaverageguy.tv/live, and there's a chat box right below that, and then we'll be able to see you, and you can at least get your questions into the show from there. Okay, averageguy.tv/live. Go ahead, John.
Okay, yeah, so I'm just going to head over to Raspberry Pi, their website, and find an image for their GERT board. Chris, you have something you want to add while I look for this?
Yeah, it's just... This is exactly, it's interesting to me because this is like the logical conclusion to the hardware hacking industry that popped up around Arduino. So this is a full Linux computer. This is unlike the Arduino boards that we have, which are also very fun. But with these things, you upload your code to the board and then it runs in a loop and you can control devices and stuff like that. And this is a little different. I mean, you plug this thing in, and you have a full Linux computer. So in some ways, I feel like this is like a complement, and it's kind of the logical conclusion. This is going to be kind of the final form factor, don't you think?
You know, I've kind of heard some grumbling about the USB ports not being powerful enough, and I think on mine here, I actually... You know, we got to put what do you call it? One of those stipulations, like don't try this at home or whatever before you start. But
which means you should immediately try it at home.
Yeah. Of course.
See, I actually did a little bit of a bypass here. I'm bringing the +5 volts, so you can see this image. There's a depending on how clear it is on the back of the board. There's a fuse, and I'm bringing 5 volts from there all the way to the USB port where there's a 5 volts. Power there. So what I'm actually bypassing the fuses, because some people were saying that the fuses are a little bit on the weak side and you can jump them. Again, if people are interested, we could put some links in the show notes about, or just go to raspberrypi.org and their forums, and there's a discussion on there. So there's a couple of little things that it's not like the greatest, but you know, for the regular, this is why sometimes, you know, if people just took out their keyboard and mouse and plugged it all in and used their regular charger, you know, they might run into a couple little problems. So it's good to know that, you know, go to their websites check out some of the detail. Like I said, my biggest thing, the first week I had it, my biggest problem was the power supply. So, you know, I lived it.
And, John, what components were you plugging in there into the USB ports when you had problems with that?
Just a regular keyboard, without any hub, and a regular wired mouse. And I was getting, like, it was booting up. Sometimes I wouldn't get a good network connection. Right. Sometimes I would be getting some error messages on the screen. So you did, you know, the monitor was plugged in, and it would do some writing, but then it would stop. And then it would get a couple of error messages and stuff. So if I unplugged the USB keyboard and mouse, and then I booted it up again, then it kind of, like, went through everything. And but that's it. My problem is because I was using a power supply that was too low. And there's a good video there. We'll put another link in the show notes for this one. There's a guy over on YouTube, and it's in our show notes. The guy talks about measuring the voltage on your Raspberry Pi. So basically, what you would do is you would use a multimeter like this there. I have a little cheap multimeter. So what you would do is you would just, you know, put it on voltage, and then you would plug in your power supply. So don't put anything in the Pi, like no SD card, no wires, no nothing. You kind of want to check it like bare bones with nothing connected. And so then you'll plug in your power. Now, it does make a difference. Your USB, your micro USB, like first of all, it's the power supply, and then also that cable that you're using. If you're using a poor quality cable, it actually will drop the voltage. So, you know, you want to kind of get yourself good one. So if you're in the U.S., I would say, you know, go to Adafruit. They have like a 5.2-volt power supply, 1 amp. So, and then get the cable from them, and you shouldn't have any problems.
And they designed this thing around the European standard. I think it's like 800 milliamps or something like that. And so I bet you in Europe people won't have as much trouble with it. But here in the U.S. and Canada, some of those cables just can't put out that kind of amperage. So you'll have to check it.
So what you would do is, so basically you would plug into the power. Here's a micro USB port, and just to remind folks that it's not like the USB port. It's just for power. There's no data here. You can't just plug in and expect to use it like a micro USB. It's just for the power. And then what happens is you have 2 points on the card. They're called TP1 and TP2. One's up in the right fat fingers, yeah. Yeah, one's in the next to the yellow video connector, and one's there at the bottom, yeah, next to the halfway between the capacitor and the HDMI connector. So what you would do is you would put the negative up on the one TP2 and then the positive on TP1, and you would measure there, and you should have 5 volts. If you have less than 5 volts, you're in trouble. And then, so that's it. So this is why if you get a 5.2 volts, chances are after the current goes through the capacitor and the voltage regulator, you know, it might dip a bit. So you should have around 5 volts, 4.9, 4. Somewhere around there. And then once you plug everything in, your keyboard and mouse, then measure again, and you should have above 4.7, yeah, 4.7, 4.75 volts. If you have lower than that, expect to have some issues. Unfortunately, you have to have a multimeter to check this out. But at least if, you know, don't think that, okay, I'm running into problems, it's a defective Raspberry Pi, I want to ship it back and start all these costs. Try to get yourself, your hands on a, either just eliminate the problem by getting yourself a good power supply, or else measure with your multimeter. Because some of the things people have tried is their power supplies, because that's one of the things, right, to keep the price of the Raspberry Pi down, is they don't supply you with the power supply or keyboard or mouse, and that's because, you know, they expand HDMI cable, because they more or less you have those things lying around the house. So,
John, let me ask you, on your power supply, is it plug-in straight into the wall, or are you coming off a USB port from your computer?
Well, that's it. The little adapter would go right into the wall, and then it has a USB type connector, so now you would put a USB cable, USB whatever it is, standard to a micro USB, and you would plug that in there. I think I have a couple of them lying around.
Chris, what are you using for your power supply?
Way I'm using mine is a little bit different, because I'm not plugging in a keyboard or a mouse. I'm plugging it in just from USB on my computer and just plugging it directly like that. But I'm not using the high power peripherals. I plugged the XB into this thing, which is a wireless communications device, and that thing doesn't pull much current, so that part is okay. And then I've been using PuTTY to SSH into it, and then use Linux that way, as opposed to plugging it into a monitor. So that's a little bit different.
Does it automatically grab an IP address then when you plug it into your network?
I plugged it in and it talked to DHCP and pulled an IP address, and then I gave it a reservation and able to get into it that way. And there's a standard username and password that they've got. It's the username is Pi and the password is Raspberry.
Nice.
Yeah, that's it. My brother has a... I keep saying that's it. My brother, that's a bad habit to say that's it. Sorry. I apologize. But my brother has a, I think it's a Belkin router. USB hub. And that thing, I think it's an amp and a half, and he's able to power his Pi with that power supply. So now it kind of eliminates a power supply, like another, you know, outlet on the wall, because what he's doing is he's using the hub to power the, you know, with a USB to micro USB cable to power the Raspberry Pi. Then he takes the hub, plugs it into the input of the USB port on the Raspberry Pi. So now he's not loading, putting any load or very little load on the USB on the two port USB on the Raspberry Pi, and then he's connecting all of the peripherals, you know, if he wants a keyboard or a camera and stuff like that. Because some guys have done some amazing projects with the USB cameras and stuff. Mind you, again, you have to find all the libraries and stuff. We'll get to that a little later. And, you know, that's it. So now you'll be plugging that in there. You can plug your, if you get a USB, like a, you know, 2.5-inch, one of those Western Digital Passport, you know, 2.5-inch drives, you know, you can't power it off the Pi. You have to plug it into a USB hub.
So, John, let me make sure I got that architecture right. So he's got this Belkin powered router or powered USB hub. He's coming out. I assume it's multi-port, three, four, five ports in it?
Yeah, seven.
Seven ports. So one of those is coming off and powering the Pi. He's going then back into that, and then everything else, or the hub is plugged into that as well. I guess I don't understand. Is it using it for both power and as a hub for the Pi?
Yeah. Okay. So that's it. So what happens is just like on these USB guys or on these power mm-hmm. plugs, right, you have that type of connector, which is like on the hub. So now you would have your wire coming from here, powering the hub, powering the Pi. He's instead of going into here, he's going into the hub.
Got it.
And on the other side, that's it. It's like one's a power, and then the other one he's using it on the Pi to use their peripherals and stuff.
And then he's plugging his hard drives or whatever else might draw more power because it's going to draw the power from the hub, not from the Pi.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good way to do it. That's be a nice see if you can track down that the model that he's got from that Belkin router Belkin USB hub.
As a matter of fact, I have a link because I was saying I think his is an amp or an amp and a half, but I know over at this week at Adafruit.com, I'll put a link for that one. They have a hub there, and I think it's I think it's around the $30 mark. I'll find it a little later and maybe show everybody a link. And that one is basically the same thing. It's a 7-port hub. It's 2 amps, so if you're going to go to Adafruit, because one of the things, right, you know, it's a great site. These guys are, I advise everybody to go to those guys. You know, if you need to get your power supply that you didn't get from your hub, from your Raspberry Pi, from Newark or Element 14 or those guys, go get it if you're in the U.S. or Canada, go grab it from Adafruit. They have the breadboards there. They have the little cobbler connectors there. So that you can connect to the GPIO port of the Raspberry Pi. They got a lot of bells and whistles. Friday, they do a blog post called Pi Day. So they have they talk about all their little peripherals that they come out with. And that's it. This week they announced that 2-amp USB hub, which is very good for the Pi. If you have the Arduinos and stuff like that, so there's some good stuff there. And the other thing is they have a learning center. So they actually are doing projects. So if you're a little bit skeptic, like one of the things I wanted to do is with the LCD screen, right? So it's like, well, how do you wire that all up, you know? Well, if you go to Adafruit, there's a lot of resources on the internet, but one I would suggest, again, is this site Adafruit. And they kind of go into it step by step. They tell you what parts you need. They give you images. There's a video. They show you, you know, how to wire it up. They give you, they talk about some software called Fritzing, which is, it's like a graphical UI. And basically all these like LCD panels or your Pi and stuff, they look like images. And you kind of bring them into this application. And then you do your wiring and stuff like that. So you're kind of doing it visually on your PC, and then after you transfer that, you know, to your physical boards and stuff like that. So they have a really good resource there.
The other software that is really popular for designing circuits and that kind of thing is Eagle. That's the one where that's like the professional open source tool that you can use, and you can. It's kind of hard to use, but if you can wrap your head around it at least, that you can actually export from that and send it off to a circuit board maker so that you can get some prototype going. So that's what the people over at Adafruit use, I think, to design all of theirs. But Fritzing is a lot more friendly and, you know, graphical and that kind of thing. So in Adafruit, for every bit of equipment that they make, they open source the reference design, and they usually have like Eagle files to download so that you can look at these things. And they have an entire project page that details where you can buy everything that they are selling you elsewhere and how to make it. And you can ask questions in their forums about it. So that website is absolutely invaluable to the kind of hardware hacking industry that's popped up.
Definitely, yeah, and that's it. Like you said, these things you can download, the software, and again, like these Fritzing libraries, you can download from them. They have, and they actually came out with, because the main person there, what's her name? Do you recall her name? Limor Fried?
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's her. Yeah, she's
Lady Ada.
Lady Ada, yeah. She's an engineer, so, I mean, she's got all the answers. And they came out with a distro distribution, like an OS, basically, called the Occidentals. And what they're doing in there is, again, go. You know, we'll put a link, or just go to adafruit.com and do a search for Raspberry Pi and look for Occidentalis. And what that is that's a Linux distribution that contains a bunch of these files. So because that's it, you know, let's say if you're going to want to use the LCD, you need, remember, like on a Windows PC, you know, you plug in a printer, you have to go get drivers. You plug in something else, a network card, you have to get drivers. So here it's a bit like that type of thing. Is you need to have that software, those drivers type thing, or those folder files on, you know, loaded into the memory of the Raspberry Pi. So a lot of these whatever these bits, software bits, they've merged it into this software. So now you'll have a lot of that stuff already, you know, preset for you. So that's a good thing.
John, you know that a lot of the guys that hang around our community are, of course, video freaks, right? They like to run video, and they've heard that this has, you know, HDMI out, and there's some, you know, been some questions about just how much video you can push through it. And have either one of you heard or know of, and Tim is asking this in chat, if they've had any luck playing, you know, Blu-ray rips with something, with the Pi. Is that really what it's designed? Can you push it that hard?
I think you could. I'll point you to, again, a link. It's I saw a interview, but Leo Laporte interviewed the creator, Eben Upton, or one of the main guys, because there's a few guys. You know, we want to give them all some credit too, you know. But Eben Upton is like the main guy, and he did a show called Triangulation with Leo Laporte. Let me see. I think I have the date here.
He said in that show also, this thing has been in the making for 6 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought that, Chris. I would have thought maybe like the last two or 18
months.
Yeah,
that's what I would have thought too. Wow. And this guy works for Broadcom, and he's the one who designed the GPU in this. And so they've got, it's like a quad-core GPU that you can push pretty hard. So even though the main CPU on this board is kind of weak, you know, ARM 700 megahertz chip. You can push that GPU to a little bit bigger limits than you can the main chip.
And exactly, yeah.
John, that date you're looking for, July 18th, 2012, on that Laporte episode over there at Twit.
There you go. Yeah, so I recommend you you listen to that. It's a good video. It's that's it. He talks about the points of, like I had brought up earlier there, where, you know, the four main goals were to make it interesting, which is 1080p, because that's a lot of times it's like, I'd like to plug this in, maybe get some software, and like get it running right away. I might not want to do some coding right off the bat. I just want to see, well, what could it do now? And then maybe later get into the details. So this is where that 1080p stuff comes in. It's like, and he mentions about Blu-ray and all of that. So, and then the speed and stuff. So he gets a little bit more technical than what I know about resolution. So listen to that. And then the second step was for it to be programmable, which is, because with the Raspberry Pi, right, is basically, you know, it's not going to do anything unless you put software on that SD card. So I think the way it's set up is there's a bootloader, which is a software on the chip that goes to look at the SD card and says, do you have any software for me to run? Yeah, okay, fine, and then it loads it. Whereas some other devices, like there's, let me see, I think it's, I forget the company, they're coming out with an Android APC, and that one, basically the software, the OS is right on the chip, so it loads Android right from the beginning, and then you would have to maybe kind of redirect it to go and get some other software that's on the SD card. But with Raspberry Pi, it's like it goes to the SD card. So if you're saying I got Linux, you know, a distribution of, let's say, Debian on there, or the RasBMC, which they recommend, or Raspbian, sorry, is their software, because Raspbian is the OS, which is like a desktop interface, and RasBMC is the multimedia stuff, that like XBMC. So then it would go to that card and would read it and then boot up and so forth.
And they're both a custom implementation of Debian Linux for ARM.
And then the fourth part, the third part I mentioned before was robust, and then the fourth goal that they had was for it to be cheap, which is cheap quality, but cheap inexpensive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been a great deal. You know, Chris, you were mentioning, how they've got a pretty nice graphics implementation on there. Mm-hmm. I mean, Moore's Law is in our favor at this point, right? I mean, this thing can't get any cheaper, but it can continue to get better as chip prices fall, right? I mean, do you guys see that? Have they talked about that in the community at all? Are there faster things yet still to come, or are they pretty content with what they've got right now?
I think they're okay for now, but you got to think that sometime in the future, once this thing settles down a little bit, that they're going to start to push it a little further. I've also seen some people overclocking this thing to a gigahertz, which is pretty crazy. But
yeah,
you know, it's funny because they're talking about their initial alpha design, and they were using a chip similar to Arduino. That's the Atmega 644 they were using, and that thing is like an 8-bit. Tiny processor that doesn't do a whole lot. And then, you know, in the past 6 years, what's happened is we've seen this emergence of ARM-based tablets and phones on the market, and that's really enabled somebody to build this thing in a way that just wasn't possible back then. So it must have been an interesting few years for those guys.
Yeah, and the point I wanted to make is these goals, you know, it's important. Like they took four good goals, because if they would have made this board just cheap, $25, $35, and you really had to kind of get software. Like if it was hard to get running, then people would say, "Oh, I don't care. It's $35. There's no interest. It's not dragging me in." So again, this is one of the points. Make it interesting. So see, making it interesting is actually more important than being cheap. It's like, you know, make it interesting. Make it that kids want to do it and stuff like that. And sometimes people, right, you know, if something is interesting, it draws them in, they don't care what the price is. It's like, that's the price. I'm willing to pay a certain amount to have some enjoyment. And if it's $25, $35, $45, or $100, then, you know, I'll pay it, you know, if you have enough to kind of pull me in. But in this case, you know, it's good that they kept that price low. And as the other point I wanted to make was, that's it. Like they were going to come out with the Model A, which I think was only one USB connection and no network connection. And this is where it actually takes less power, whereas this one, yeah, takes 700 milliamps. I think that one took around 400 or less. So quite half as much, 350, 400 milliamps. So, but then, you know, folks were kind of saying, well, as soon as they get it, they said the first thing they're going to do is add a network connection. Mm-hmm. So they said, hey, for the $10, we'll put it in. Which, in a way, you kind of think, you know, I'm kind of thinking $10 just for the network connection, you know, they should have did that for $3 or $5, you know? But I'm just being greedy.
Yeah, John, I'm not sure you have any room to complain with a $35 device.
Yeah, I can't go. There you go. So, but there you go. So, and I think once, again, they're up to 4,000 boards a day, and I think once they get enough of these out in the market, then I think, I hope that they release that Model A, because it's on the books, you know. So some people say, well, look, I'd like to have that Model A. I don't really need, you know, even like as far as the GPU, you know, graphics. Like guys like you that want to say, well, I want to use this as a PHP server or a Twonky Media server or a Squeeze Play server and that type of thing. It's like, I don't really need the graphics. I just want to be able to interface to it and run some Arduino hardware and stuff like that. So I can do that with the $25 board. So, and then the other thing that I do know that they've confirmed is, like you said earlier, is the camera. So, and that's something that they're going to come out with. Whereas the, you know, now more or less people are coming out with their own little boards. Like there's a bunch of little links that you can get these add-on boards. Like I said, Adafruit, they have their little cobbler and stuff to connect stuff. But some guys are actually making these little daughter boards where that they have like relays on it. So now you can run stepper motors and stuff like that, and so there's a market aftermarket. So these little boards, so there you go. So that's there's a good business in there. And then the other thing is cases. Maybe in the future we'll order ourselves some cases, but that's one of the thing that you know, they didn't supply when they made, again, to keep the cost down and all that, is they didn't make a case available. And now you're starting to see a lot of good choices available. Again, Adafruit has a clear case that you kind of, you know, you buy it in pieces and you assemble it. Be very, very careful when you
case.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. And be very careful because acrylic tends to be like a bit of a hard plastic. And if you kind of break one, because they have like these claws on it, you have to put the piece on and then lock it. And some people are kind of doing it the wrong way. So the little hook part that holds the part that's the side plate that's really small, and you might snap it off. And you snap it off, now you're going to be using some contact cement. So that's your choice. And then another nice choice was a guy came out with one called the pie bow. Have you heard about that one?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, it's like pie from Raspberry Pi and bow from Rainbow. And what that one is, it's a multi-layer colored case. And that's it. It's like, I think it's acrylic. It's like maybe 7 slices of pie, different colors.
Nice.
And you just kind of stack them. And maybe we can put a link on that one. But just Google Raspberry Pi. Google's your friend, Raspberry Pi, pie bow. And they're starting to ship those. And that's another nice little phenomenon there where, it's like this guy comes up with an idea for Raspberry Pi and, people are banging down his door to try and get their hands on them.
And also, since this thing is at the nexus of the hardware hacking world, you've also got a bunch of people who happen to have 3D printers like the MakerBot and stuff like that. And they're making designs and, printing them out and selling them on eBay and stuff like that. So this is kind of wide open for the community to this is one piece that is wide open to the community to build cases for it and even print them at home. I wish I had a 3D printer to do that kind of thing with.
Yeah, so do I. I've seen some websites. I think it's one is called
Thingiverse.com.
Thingiverse, there you go.
Yeah.
I came across those guys, and I think that's it. Uh-huh. You have your drawings that people are posting because it's like an open source type thing. People are posting their drawings. So if you go over there, you can download those drawings. And if you have a guy local, because, let's say this kind of the Raspberry Pi grew out from these guys, Eben Upton and his guys over in Cambridge, in London, in England. So there's like everything is kind of like growing over there. So you see some of those guys. I think the Pi Bow case guy is out in the UK. So sometimes you might find it expensive, to ship some stuff to you. So now if you go to this site and you download these drawings for the cases, you might be able to find some local guy. And, you just walk in with a piece of plexiglass or acrylic and you say, hey, here's the design. I don't have a 3D printer. I don't have a laser, in this case, a laser printer, a laser cutter. And then you just supply him the plastic. You give him the drawing and say, can you make this for me for $10? So, and there's also these hacker spaces and stuff that they might have either access to a 3D printer or a laser printer.
Yeah, those things are starting to get actually reasonably priced. You can get some not assembled 3D printers that you have to solder together yourself for a few $100. I'd have to look it up to give you an actual price, but somewhere on the order of like $300-$500, as opposed to these things used to be, thousands and thousands of dollars, and they're starting to come down themselves a little bit too. We're seeing Moore's Law prove itself again there.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your XB and some of your stuff that you have there as far as connecting to the GPIO port.
Sure. So what I wanted to get this thing for was to just be a little development box. I've had like a netbook sitting off in the corner that I hooked an XB unit up to get some wireless communications going. And this thing is perfect for that. It's $35. You could buy 3 or 4 of these things and not feel it too hard in the wallet. And it's perfect for kind of the lone wolf web developer. I mean, you can install PHP and MySQL. That's kind of the technology stack that Facebook is built on, for example. It's called LAMP Stack and the LAMP server. And you can even install Webmin, which is a standard Linux UI to configure things. Like, you can even make a proxy server out of this. You can make a VPN server. You can do all kinds of stuff. Just because it's running Linux, you just opens up this wide range of software capabilities. So so I put PHP on it, and I put an XB on it, and I wrote a PHP library for XB so that I could interface with this thing through GPIO pins or through the USB connection. And then you can talk remotely from that web server to any other arbitrary XB, since it's a mesh network. So there's really an incredible amount of possibilities there. I even saw somebody install MySQL Server on this thing in a 2 Raspberry Pi cluster, which is pretty wild. You know, I said earlier, why'd you buy just one? You should buy 2 and then cluster them.
A stacked cluster?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I've been doing. You know, I've at least got the capability now to turn off a little LED remotely. You know, that's always the first step. Can you blink that LED?
Yeah, that's what matters.
Yeah. It's like saying, you know, when you're writing a program and you want it to output hello world, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Right, same kind of deal, yeah.
So I've also seen, John, maybe you'll be interested in this, that somebody wrote, I think it was with Arduino and XB, a program to talk to a 16x2 LCD display with an XB remotely and PHP.
Cool. I'll have to get my hands on an XB and see how that goes. Because I've heard that name before. I've never got into the Arduino stuff. But, yeah, I've always played around with the little boards and doing some wiring and stuff like that. And, yeah, it makes me think, check out those guys at Adafruit there last night. On Saturday yeah. night, they have their show. And I think they said that they're releasing like 3 types of XB. Have you seen that? Check out their site, and I think they have one XB Pro and then X. Like they mm-hmm. actually showed on this on the monitor like 3 different boxes, devices, and they were saying how they're kind of in touch with the whoever that makes those boards, because you know to get low prices for the customers and to also to create these libraries and stuff like that to make all that software available and stuff. So there's a nice community around that.
Yeah, actually, the way they do these things are really confusing. There's the XB Series 1, which is the one that I have, and that's like really low power. And then there's the Series 2, and there's the Pro, and they all have different features. And I think the Pro does like actual Zigbee communication, whereas the Series 1 can't. It can only go over their implementation of Zigbee. So if you're going to go buy one of these things, make sure you do your research and go to Adafruit and SparkFun and guys like that and look around and see what's out there. But I've only got the Series 1 here.
Okay. All right. A couple of links I wanted to point out too was another one was called the Magpie Magazine. This guy, if you've seen it, I think it came out in July. It's like an online, it's you know, a community of people interested, just like us, we're interested in the Raspberry Pi. And what they do is they have an online magazine that you can download. So it's monthly. So, you know, download that PDF and take a look. And they got some good resources in there. They talk about the software, like programming using Scratch. They talk about these little boards, again, how to wire them up. They got some diagrams there. Because, you know, sometimes you need to see something written down. You know, if somebody's just telling you how to do it verbally, that might not be enough, which is what's nice about Adafruit, their learning center. But these guys got some good information. I think the latest edition of the Magpie, they had an interview with Eben Upton and his wife Liz, and so that's a good read. Look forward to that every month. The other places I like is there's a YouTube channel called Linux. What was it? Raspberry Pi for Beginners.
The Linux Action Shows. What you're talking about.
There's a Linux Action Show, which they have a one video, which about halfway through they talk about the Raspberry Pi. So that's a good episode to take a look at. This other one was Raspberry Pi Beginners on YouTube. So check that out. This guy comes out with he's a student, and comes out with a bunch of different videos of how to do different things with the Raspberry Pi. So that's something nice I've checked out. Let me see.
You know, you've built something kind of incredible when little cottage YouTube video publishers start cropping up around what you've made. That's pretty incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like you got that following, which is you know, it's a bit like free advertising. Like these, guys, they don't have to go and pay to advertise the Raspberry Pi. It's they put as long as they got like a nice logo and something that's, you know, fun, that's attractive, and then, you know, the good product, and then like it'll sell itself, you know. So that's great. And then the other two sites I would say to go visit is I've been finding a lot of my information when I kind of got interested in Raspberry Pi came from Andrew Edney's site over at Connected Digital World. So he does a lot of posts on Raspberry Pi, and also he and Ian Dixon, who's owns the site the Digital Lifestyle, he does some posts also. They have a Raspberry Pi section on their site.
So Ian Dixon got in really early on the Raspberry Pi. He must have gotten one of the first ones that was made. He must have ordered it like at midnight the night that it was available or something like that.
Yeah.
So well, he's been doing good work over there.
Yeah, they're like these two guys are in the UK, right? So I mean, even Andrew Edney there, he was fortunate enough. They had like a Raspberry Pi Jam, or Raspberry Jam, which is where these communities, again, free publicity. It's like these people are getting together, people who have Raspberry Pis or don't have Raspberry Pis, you know, they like to get some information. And now there's this guy, O'Donoghue, I think his name is. I'll have to find details. Sorry if I messed up your name. And he's kind of setting up together these Raspberry Jams. And, you know, there's a website that you go and you say, I want to set it up and invite people and stuff. And you know, they get together. So one of these Raspberry Jams, I think it was the one that was in Cambridge, Andrew Edney was there, and he was taking some photos. As a matter of fact, one of his photos is the cover photo of the latest Magpie magazine. So he took some photos there, and he was able to. He was carrying a box of 100 Raspberry Pis from their car to, you know, to the table, thinking, you know, how do I get away from here with this box? You know,
how do I do it?
Yeah, so he's lucky to get, or fortunate, I should say, to get some firsthand, you know, even the interviews and, you know, talking to Eben Upton and his crew, and that's it. So if you listen to their podcast, they got some. Every once in a while, they talk a little bit about some Raspberry Pi news.
Now, John, you said the Raspberry Pi Jam, and it makes me think of starting to try and get some music processing going in this little device. I hadn't thought of that before. I'll have to see if it has some kind of like MIDI capabilities or something like that, control keyboards and stuff like that. I'll have to look into that.
Cool. Yeah, you'd think that it would be a perfect kind of add-on device to plug in, maybe MIDI out and then right into the keyboard and give it some effects, record some sequencing.
Yeah, there's some cottage little industry out there with Arduino and processing DSP, audio signals and that kind of thing. So I'm sure that'll happen with the Raspberry Pi too, since it has so much more processing power than the Arduino and all of its clones and all that. So I don't know. I hadn't really thought about that, but I wouldn't mind jamming with my Raspberry Pi. That would be kind of cool.
You know, a couple years back, we tried this one laptop per child program, and it never really. I mean, it came and it went. They just were expensive to develop. From what you guys know, is this a platform that can? I mean, could I realistically put this in a box that had a UI and could I create a, you know, it'd need to be a Linux distribution of some kind, but could I create a workable PC out of this thing? We talk about it controlling stuff, but would it do the job of replacing a PC, so to speak?
Well, I think it's a little bit underpowered for that. I mean, it depends. You'd have to set your expectations right for it because, if you want to boot this thing up, you're not going to be encoding video and stuff like that, but or at least not in any efficient manner. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's at a place where you could boot up Firefox or whatever it is and browse around the web for a little while. But, you know, it's not going to be, you know, it's, I'm not going to be ditching my Core i7 that's on my floor over
right? Chris, in the context of the one laptop per child, is it possible that this could be the front end to get, you know, computing? John, you said one of the goals of this project was to get, you know, to get this inexpensive hardware into kids' hands for education. Could we see this replacing at least some devices or kids building their own tablet-like devices that runs some kind of Linux distribution? And is there a good touchscreen distro for Linux that would be like a Android or a, you know, an iPhone distro?
I'd say it would be Android, actually.
Yeah. Well, but will this run Android?
Not yet. I think there are some people that are working on porting it right now, but I don't think they've had success yet.
Yeah. So I guess that was my thought, is without Android being there yet, is there anything today that I could use that's in the Linux world that I could put on it right away, run it off a touchscreen and it might actually work. Do you guys know?
I would say no. So like okay. Touchscreen, forget it, you know. And I think there's been versions. I think I've heard of Arc Linux. So again, for young kids, you know, getting into using the Raspbian OS, which is originally they had I think it was called Debian Squeeze. And what happens is some guys on the ARM processor takes care. They have a thing called Hardpoint. Is it called Hardpoint, Chris? Or there's.
I think it was floating point. There was some very specific thing that they needed to get this working.
Yeah, so that's it. There was this floating point technology that's on there, and if you could have the OS take advantage of this floating point, whatever technology, it would run 40% faster. Hmm. So now that's what they call now Raspbian. So if you use that software compared to the original one, the original was really slow. And, you know, if you went to, like, don't open, like, it did have a browser, you know, but don't open 5 tabs. It's kind of, like,
right.
Slow.
Yeah.
So it's good, like, you know, for, you know, 7-year-old, 10-year-olds that are kind of, like, you know, want to just, you know, there's, you know, they got their whole life ahead of them, you know, it doesn't matter. But they, remember when we had the Commodore 64, it's like, okay, load it and now go get yourself a coffee while it loads, you know? So it's a bit like, as far as using software, I find it's a bit like, you know, those earlier versions of Commodore 64 and VIC-20s and stuff like that. But the thing is if you go in the direction, like Chris was saying, that if you set it up as a PHP device or, you know, or maybe like an alarm system or something like that, then it's got a lot of good points there. And like you said, I think that, like we said, is the Android. Some of these guys might port that over. We'll have to see how quick that gets because, you know, us as adults, I think we get a little quite impatient if things aren't done very quickly. You know, we want to have 5 browsers open and, you know, so I don't think it can hack it.
Yeah, so there's some notion of having this be a programming educational computer for kids. You know, when I was a kid, I remember sitting down at our 286 and programming in QBasic at the command line. And if you want to do that with your dad, right, that is something that can happen now again. So there's some nostalgia maybe for us to be able to kind of pass that along instead of, you know, kids these days growing up have it good, right? They've got computers that are too powerful, so maybe we can knock them back with this little kind of board, right?
My 15-year-old just bought, you know, or just built himself a Core i7 3770, you know, just rocking fast, 2 gig GPU. He's out there. You know, he basically is playing all his games in max mode at this point, and he's loving it because he had a piece of crap PC for the longest time, but... he's not, you know, this, he thinks, you know, programming is downloading the games from Steam, you know, and, at this point, this is a good go back to basics type device that you really can do some hacks on and get back down into the code. Even at the very basics, you know, the very base level of the code will allow some hacking on that. And it could be good for this next generation.
Yeah, I mean, so you can SSH in there with the command line and use Pico to write code. You know, it's a command line text editor, and compile it. You know, maybe Python, and then you can run your code on that device even remotely without a monitor directly attached to it. So there's a lot of possibilities there.
Oh. Yeah, Chris, I just wanted to touch on, like you said, with coding and stuff. Like a bit the way Linux stuff works is. You know, like let's say you install some kind of app and then you want to get like drivers and stuff, or you need this software. There's this like GitHub, right? Or, you know, sometimes in the code you would write get what is a get app? Because I'm not too familiar with the names, but you would go get
sudo
apt
get PHP 5, for example.
Yeah. So what happens is now your device, because it's connected to the internet, it would go to this a pool somewhere out in the cyberspace.
Yeah,
world there.
Repository.
Yeah, repository. Yeah. That's it. And it would grab the files you would need and then install it. So that's neat how Linux kind of does their things. And so can you just explain what that GitHub is? And because sometimes you can go to the site and you can see that they have these libraries and there's some information. Can you give us a little bit of what that is?
Yeah, it's just a place for people to get together and write open source code. That's kind of the base of it. It's a little divorced from the apt-get package manager. So it's a little bit different in that because Debian manages a bunch of repositories. And So when you say sudo apt-get, you're looking toward the repositories that they've set up. And so, for example, if you follow the link in the show notes to install a LAMP server, you say sudo apt-get PHP 5, and then you say the same thing for MySQL, and you say the same thing for Apache, and then you've got a LAMP server. And you can put your PHP-based website up on that and code it like that. And then GitHub is just an open source place to put code. And so you can go there, like I wrote this little library for PHP for the XB, and I thought, okay, well, I'll just put it out there. And, if somebody wants to fix it, the code's open source and they can submit a patch and that kind of thing. And that's where most of these open source guys go to put their code so that people can look at it, people can fix it and that kind of thing. Apt-get and GitHub are a little bit different, but they're both kind of repositories for things.
Okay, so and the apt-get is more like from within the Linux distribution or whatever command line, you go and grab your stuff. Whereas the other one is like you can be on your PC, you browse, you say, oh, look, this kind of library or it does what I want. So now you would download that, then maybe SSH into your Raspberry Pi and then put it in a folder and then now at the Pi you would say, okay, go into that folder and the files are there and execute them.
Right, exactly right. Now, also I mentioned Webmin earlier, which is a pretty cool utility where you install Webmin and then instead of going to the command line in SSH, you just go to the router's, go to the Raspberry Pi's IP address, and they give you a bunch of utilities where you can install packages just from a little web UI there instead of going through the command line. So you can just say, hey, give me PHP or give me this proxy server, like Squid Proxy or something like that. So that might make it a little bit easier to use for somebody who's a little uncomfortable SSHing in and using command line.
Cool. All right, so with that, we'll wrap it up. I just want folks to know that I do have I was lucky enough to get a donation from somebody, and they ordered me one of those GERT boards. So that's on a boat from somewhere, or in a plane, or a truck, or whatever.
On a slow boat from China?
Yeah, so some actually from the UK. So
okay.
Because it's that guy, Gert Van Loo, who is over in the UK, and so eventually he'll get here, and I'll have to get myself, again, with the surface mount technology, I'll have to get myself a big magnifying glass and some tweezers and try to do some soldering. So eventually, when I get that done and do some more experimenting, then I hope we can get together and do another podcast and talk about that.
Also, I hope we get a picture of you with your magnifying glass and your tweezers. That would be classic.
Yeah. One of the big round ones and bright light and that stuff coming in. Good.
Maybe a fisheye lens picture. Yeah. Be good.
Very. John, hey, Chris, where can we find you during the week? If folks pop in here, I know you do a couple other things outside of your normal job, but where can we find you online?
Sure, you can get me on Twitter. That's the most likely suspect there, at Chris Hale Barnes. It's H-A-L-E. And you can also find my podcast, The End User, at thedigitalmediazone.com. And so it's T-H-E-N-D-U-S-R, spelled Linux-like.
Very good. And John, of course, you and I podcast each week over at the Home Server Show, homeservershow.com. And John is a regular guest, it seems like. Not as much as lately as it's been in the past, but we got to get you back on the Home Tech Podcast at TheAverageGuy.tv. Gentlemen, thanks for both of you for coming in today. And I think maybe the first of many podcasts. Is that what we call them? I don't know. Who knows?
Sure.
Who knows what we'll come up with? Everybody have a great afternoon. Thanks for coming in today, guys.
If you have any comments or questions or would like to contribute or donate for future hardware projects, send Jim an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.